Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome to episode 236 of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. My name is Brian Salvatore. Thank you for joining us this week. We are going to have a jam-packed show where we are slightly desperate about the Mets situation, but I think we handle ourselves with at least a little bit of decency about it, so we'll see. Anyway, first up, Chris McShane and I talk about the last week of sort of the insane Mets. You can hear my son in the background moaning and lamenting the way they handle these injuries, and spoiler alert, you're going to hear me moaning about it too in just a second. Well, Chris, the last time we spoke, things weren't great for the Mets, but somehow things have gotten so much worse in the week or so since we've chatted. Let's just start with last Thursday's game. So Thursday's game was supposed to be a Noah Syndergaard start, and he was scratched from the game with bicep tendonitis, I believe is what they called it. And he was going to be skipped until Sunday. So Matt Harvey started in his place. Matt Harvey, who reportedly did a heavy lifting session on Wednesday and so was not necessarily in the best condition to pitch the game. During batting practice that day, Yoenis Cespedes fell down in pain while taking batting practice and yet still started for the Mets and shockingly came out of the game. Harvey did not have a great start. Syndergaard, in front of a bunch of reporters, lambasted your best friend and mine, Jay Horowitz. And am I forgetting anything from Thursday?
They lost.
They did lose, but that's not all that unusual at this point. Let's just start there. How many ways did the Mets fuck up that day?
I don't know.
Lots, though, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
What do you think is the most egregious event from that day?
I would say Cespedes playing, because that was obvious. You know, he had missed a few games. They got lucky with the rain out on Tuesday night. Got an extra day for him, right? That was the sequence of it, I think.
Yes.
If my memory is correct here. So, yeah, he had missed the games over the previous weekend. We knew he didn't pinch hit. We knew he wasn't really available. They get the off day, the extra day with the rain out, and, you know, he gets right back in there in the everyday lineup. And, you know, seems to make the hamstring worse. So to me, that was obvious because, you know, you saw it happen. You knew he wasn't available. The DL these days is pretty short. You know, I know they had the series with the Nationals, but the way it worked out, you know, the not the one at home that preceded it, but the series with the Nationals that was coming up afterwards, the way it worked out without him was relatively okay in terms of wins and losses.
Right.
You know, we'll get to the rest of that later, but they won two out of three. The outfield is probably the deepest part of the team right now. I mean, you to be in a spot where Conforto and Bruce have hit really well, and, you know, you've got three other players on the team. Cespedes should be the best of the three. He's been excellent when he's been healthy, but, you know, it's a spot where if you go, you know what, we got to get through a national series, but we've still got Conforto and Bruce in the corners. Granderson and Lagares can split the time at center. It just doesn't seem like it was that hard to put him on the DL. So that to me is the most egregious, just because the downside was pretty minimal, and hamstrings are weird. Like we all know that. So, yeah, I don't know. So that would be number one. Number two would just be that they didn't tell Harvey a little bit sooner, hey, we might need you.
Right.
You know, the game gets rained out. We hear Gesellman is going to get skipped that night of the rainout. You know, oh, we'll skip Gesellman's turn in the rotation. And then Terry Collins says the next day, No, we never said that. Like, what? I don't that. It's weird because, you know, I'm in a place where I'm not getting super worked up about bad sports news generally. So I won't provide the you know, the fire on the Syndergaard stuff when we get to it. But things like that, pretending 12 hours later that, you know, I don't know if he said it himself, but certainly the reporters didn't just make it up.
Right.
You know, Gzelman's going to be skipped. We get to the ballpark. So what happened to that? Well, we never said we were going to skip him. Like, what?
Do you think that is? Do you think that that is
clearly
a case of the team not communicating, or the front office not communicating with the manager, where Collins didn't know that was said, or do you think it's just him trying to cover his ass, or like what's your possible explanation for that situation? Because I think all of them are pretty damning.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know which is the most likely. I think everybody knew what they said the night before and they changed their mind in the morning. And he's the one who's out there and said, no, we never changed our mind. You know, we're sticking with the rotation the way we drew it up. But clearly, you know, relating to Harvey, clearly at that point, when you had Gzelman make that start, you know, that would have been early enough to say, hey, Matt, you know, we're not so sure how things are going to go tomorrow. We may need you to make that start. So prepare as if you're starting. So yeah, that that is number two for me on the Thursday egregiousness rankings.
All right. Well, you know, you kind of talked about how the first 2 days of the National Series went pretty well for the Mets. And, you know, more or less it did. The only maybe bit of news that we can talk about that isn't just recapping a game is that Noah Syndergaard refused to take an MRI for the team. I believe that was Friday, correct?
Yeah, it would have been that day. I believe that was the day he threw the bullpen instead. You know, everything went well.
Mm-hmm.
With that at that point in time.
Yeah. I don't want this to become pick on Syndergaard because I really like Syndergaard. He's been a guest on our show, so he gets somewhat of a pass from me forever. But it just seems to me like refusing to take an MRI, I don't know what the positive outcome for that is. I don't know what he thought. I don't know if he just thought he was, you know, drawing a line in the sand and showing ownership that, I don't know, you don't mess with him. I don't know what his intended message with that is. But I think that realistically, an MRI has such a little chance of, I mean, there is almost no way an MRI can make a baseball player more hurt than he is when he goes into the MRI machine. So I see no reason to make a big deal out of this. But Syndergaard clearly felt this was something, a place he had to take a stand, and he refused the MRI. Well, you know, fast forward a few days later, and he winds up with a seemingly unrelated lat tear. I don't know how much I believe the unrelated nature of it, but, and the Mets, you know, he's pulled in the second inning of the game, and he, and the Mets go on to have a historically bad game on Sunday, giving up 23 runs to the Nationals. What do you make of this whole Syndergaard situation?
I am probably one of very few people who doesn't have an issue with him deciding he didn't want the MRI. I, you know, I don't think anyone can say for sure exactly what happened with the lat. You know, it's possible that what he was feeling with his biceps and the lat were related all along. It's possible that they weren't. You know, I think he certainly went out on Sunday trying to throw as hard as he could, and he did. He hit 99, 100, and 101, you know, at least once or twice each in that first inning. So I guess to me, I don't have as much, you know, he can choose to do whatever he wants to do. Maybe it wasn't the best decision, but, you know, not wanting to do the MRI at that point. Okay. That's his choice. You know, nobody can force him to do anything medically that he doesn't want to do. But he certainly came out throwing at max effort on Sunday. And I just don't know, you know, if it was related, the biceps issue. I think the infamous line about it at this point was that he had said that he couldn't lift his shoulder above his head or his arm above his head or whatever when it had tightened up on him, I think would be the best way to describe it. It certainly could be related. It probably seems like it's likely that it's related, but he can make that decision on his own and everything. But obviously when he got out there and actually pitched, you know, things got worse. So it's sort of, you know, the more minor things that have happened in the last few weeks, you know, dude has gets his elbow hyperextended on a freak play at first base. You know, Darnold had sat out a couple games because he, you know, his hand made contact with a bat when he was making a throw. We know he's in tonight's game as we record this. He actually left a little early because his wrist was a little sore. You know, those kinds of things, they happen. You know, they're, even though it's not a contact sport in the sense that football and hockey are, those things come up, they can happen. But the piling on of Cespedes missing just a brief time, coming back and suffering a worse injury, and then Syndergaard essentially doing the same thing 3 days later, makes it all feel a lot worse.
Okay, so I want to know more about your opinion on this. I understand that a team cannot make a player do anything medically. And as we've talked about before, I will come down on the side of the player 99 times out of 100 when it comes to a player making a decision versus a team making a decision for a player. That said, don't you think the team has every right to say, well, if you're not going to take an MRI, we're not going to let you start on Sunday?
Right. And they could have done that. You know, they could have either skipped the turn again. And I mean, they've been carrying too many pitchers all season anyway. So they could have started Gil Martin and not put him on the DL and skipped the turn. They could have put him on the DL. You know, that he doesn't have to consent to. And I don't think he would have filed a grievance over it. That, you know, maybe it would have been a point of contention, but those are things that they certainly could have done. I guess for me, from his perspective, he feels something. He probably genuinely felt better. You know, I mean, only he knows exactly how much better he felt from the time that he couldn't pitch to through the time he threw the bullpen and then went out and made the start. But, you know, he probably felt better. He probably didn't want, I mean, I don't want to echo Ron Darling too much, but in the discussion that they've had in the booth about it since then, you know, Ron kind of came back to the same point a couple of times that, hey, I'm a pitcher. I if I can avoid the MRI machine, I will, because you never know what's going to come up in there, which is sort of a, you know, that may not be the best approach for the player, because I think you might want to know if something was wrong.
Right.
But that was his apprehension, essentially. You don't want to go in there for biceps tendonitis and then come out with something else is an issue. You know, it's sort of one thing I can say about the entire situation is that he got the Mets doctors off the hook in terms of public perception. Because there's every chance, right? Say he goes in, we, and everybody said this, we'll never know, But say he goes into the MRI tube, comes out, everything looks clean. You know, they look at the biceps. Yep. If, as long as it feels better, there's nothing that shows up here that concerns us. Go ahead. You're clear. Go pitch. So if that happens, then it goes out and the same exact thing happens.
Yeah.
There would probably be, an NYPD contingent outside the hospital for special surgery with Mets fans trying to get in. And it's tough because obviously they've had their two best players, at least in the broad sense of the word. You know, maybe Conforto ends up being one of those two by the end of the season, but they've had both of them hit the shelf. Cespedes, I would think, would be a much shorter term, but still not short term. They're both on the shelf at the same time. One of them can be sort of accounted for a little bit better. The other one can't. But yeah. I don't know. Does any of it make sense?
It does.
I think when you're in it, it's probably very different. Like when you're the person going through it, it's probably a very different experience that you don't have, you know, media, fans, everybody. There's this outside perception, a sense of what we think the Mets are and what, you know, what they do when they handle injuries and what they don't do and how things work out. I would guess the individual player, especially a pitcher, it's not that they're not tuned in with their own team, but I would guess they don't have any of those perceptions that we have. You know, I could be wrong, but you'd have to wait for everybody on this Mets team to retire to get somebody to give you a straight answer on
right
whether or not they had distrust or concern about the process. So I guess for me, I don't have a problem with making the decision that he made personally. I would probably have a little bit more of an issue with the team not sort of forcing his hand, not in the medical sense, but just in the, you know, the roster sense, especially once they had won the first two games. Then that third game was, given the context of everything, gravy.
Right.
And Sean Gilmartin starting a game is the least inspiring thing ever. And it would have created a whole nother storm of, what's wrong with Syndergaard? You know, he's supposed to start once. He got scratched. He's supposed to start again. Happened another time. You know, what's the deal here? But yeah, I think that sums it up. And then I guess the lesson to be learned is, you know, from the player's perspective, and in the long run, this injury doesn't, it wasn't the very best case where, you know, maybe just a lat strain, a partial tear, obviously will take him a little more time to come back from. But in the long run, if everything goes smoothly, he comes back and he is himself, which I don't have any doubt about that at this point. It can be something that people maybe don't forget, but maybe don't think of as the first thing that comes to mind when they think of his name.
You know? Right, yeah.
And then in that sense, the next time something comes up, he can, you know, get the MRI or whatever. And if he cares about this, he may not, but he can get the MRI, do whatever. And then if he gets hurt, then, hey, look, I did everything I was asked to do. You know, got the opinion of the, you know, the professionals, and this is the way it turned out. So yeah, I don't know. I don't get sanctimonious anymore with sports, and that, you know, I'm not a candidate to leave the podcast and host a show on WFAN for at least that reason, maybe several others, but certainly that one. So yeah, I don't know. That is the calmest reaction I think I can provide for what the hell happened with Syndergaard.
Thank goodness one of us can.
The Cespedes thing still pisses me off a little bit more.
I understand that, because the Cespedes thing, there was visual evidence earlier that day.
Right.
And that's really absurd. That said, I think that the Cespedes situation is certainly worse than the team's part, but I think the Syndergaard situation is a worse omen for the season.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so sort of looking ahead, to me, I just want, you know, even if they lose this Tuesday night game to the Braves, which
looks likely.
Yeah. They're trying to mount a comeback right now as we're speaking. But if that falls short and they lose, they're not that far under 500. You know, it's sort of, and this is not super exciting, but this is the two wild card era of baseball.
Right.
They really just have to play slightly above 500, you know, or at least for a couple weeks, get back to that point, and then just tread water around 500 until, you know, something changes, until either Mats comes back or Lugo potentially comes back, or Syndergaard himself does, or Cespedes. Because that is enough to contend. You know, we saw the frustration of what the one game wild card is, but, you know, there's still a lot of time between now and the end of July. And because of that sort of low threshold to be relevant for the last 2 months of the regular season, they at least have time. You know, that if you can tread water and do that and then get some of these guys back, maybe get to the trade deadline, and, you know, if things are going well enough, supplement the roster with acquisitions from outside. And if things have completely gone off the rails, then, you know, gear up for 2018.
I just want to say, you're the optimist on the show. You're the one who has advocated for possibly dealing away talent this year. So,
well, no, I'm trying to be.
I'm teasing.
I know. I'm trying to. I saw people on Twitter. Some of them are friends of the site, users of the site, whatever. I saw people on Twitter like the second it happened, like, trade players away right now, immediately. And that's not that's not the instant reaction I had. But you have a lot of time to figure that out. There's not really a sense of urgency in my mind to give up on this season. And, you know, I think by July 31st, you'll know if that's something that should be considered.
Yeah.
So all I'm saying is, as bad as they've looked, you know, they were 7-3, which feels like a year ago right now.
Seriously.
But as bad as they've looked since then, I think last weekend made the point that they, like, still weren't the Blue Jays, and they're still not the Blue Jays, at least in terms of the overall record. You know, I don't know what it says that I keep going back to, like, hey, here's the worst team in baseball, and the Mets aren't that.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Toronto's 9-17. The Mets are 11-14 at this moment, probably 11-15 soon.
Yeah, by the time they hear this, by the time listeners hear this, they could be another one up in the win column for tomorrow, or another two down in the loss column. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, but it's not. I don't know. I mean, it's just sort of the way baseball is right now. You know, they're regardless of what happens, they're going to wake up with a better record than the Giants, who also have a long term injury to a pitcher. Which I will say this: all Noah Syndergaard tried to do was his job. He tried to pitch. And that's what cost him potentially 2 months, probably-ish. So at least he didn't get on a dirt bike.
Yeah.
That would annoy me more. You know, like getting caught up in the moment and maybe thinking you're healthier than you are, that kind of thing. I can at least understand how that happens. I'm not a dirt bike guy myself.
No, neither am I.
So, you know, I'm sure people who are into it, it's recreational, it's fun, whatever. But that would annoy me much more. That I think I'd get you know, more on a player for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, is there anything more frustrating than an athlete getting hurt doing something just incredibly dumb? Like, not that dirt biking is dumb, but, like, when you're an athlete whose body is insured for tens of millions of dollars, you shouldn't be going dirt biking.
Who was the, I'm just going to Google this to answer my own question, but the NBA player who made a joke about not dirt biking, was it Steph Curry, I think?
It might have been, yeah.
Yeah, it was. At some point, somebody asked what he was doing in his time off or whatever in between playoff games, and he said, I won't be riding a dirt bike.
Yeah.
Oh, hold on. Hold on. I'm not doing play-by-play, but all of a sudden.
What just happened? I'm not watching the game. I'm in a room without a TV.
Oh, okay. Well, at this particular moment in time, Jay Bruce hit a grand slam in the ninth.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Cut the deficit to two. Man, isn't it nice to have him around? Can I change the subject from depressing injuries to Jay Bruce being the best player in baseball?
Second best. Conforto's the best in baseball.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, you know. It is funny that those two have both been so good.
Yeah. Instead of being an either or, it's both.
Right. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I think right now with Bruce, you're kind of seeing it played out in front of you why people could look at WAR and go, I don't put any credence into that. Because even as a person who does, the notion that Jay Bruce, when he was hitting like this, was barely worth anything to his team last year is insane.
Right.
His defense is not that bad. It's not good. You know, he's not good, especially balls over his head. He's not good, but he's not Lucas Duda in the outfield. And I would say, well, no, okay, that might be a little bit too far. I was about to say, even if he were, that could still be a valuable player for you. Duda was really, really bad out there. And so was Daniel Murphy and Todd Hundley.
Oh, God, Daniel Murphy.
The Mets have quite the history of making – the outfield should be the easiest to play, and they've put some guys out there who just, you know.
Yeah, I know.
But, yeah, anyway, Jay Bruce. What was my point?
how WAR could be deceiving.
Oh, right. Yeah. So for a guy to be hitting like that, and I know it doesn't say that about him this year, you know, 4 weeks into the season or whatever, but this is what he looked like early in the year in Cincinnati last year, where, you know, I mean, his numbers were fairly similar to what they are right now. So for somebody who wants to look at it and say, oh, you know, that's just a replacement level player, I can understand how people, if they're watching it, would say, well, no, that's absurd.
Right. That's an excellent point. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I, you know, anyone who has any sort of statistical mind will say you should never just use one stat. And I know WAR tries to be the easiest. Like if you're only looking at one stat, WAR tries to be the easiest one to look at to give you a complete picture of a player, but it just there's not one stat that does that. So,
yeah, and now actually looking back at it on through the end of play on May 1st last year, Bruce wasn't even this good. He was good, but he wasn't this good. I mean. He was hitting 256, 322, 487. He had, let's see how many home runs. Time-honored tradition on the show. I'm clicking on Baseball Reference.
Yep.
But yeah, at this point last year, he had hit 4 home runs, had an 809 OPS. That's, you know, that's pretty good. That's a useful major league hitter. And yeah. This year, I mean, tonight, 2 home runs. He's up to 9 home runs. The line is, he's slugging 626 at the moment.
Yeah. He's looking real good.
Yeah. And hey, we brought up, did they even pick up his option on the podcast?
So, you know, we did.
I'm not just pointing fingers at other people here, but if we're talking about Noah Syndergaard learning lessons, I guess we can talk about ourselves a little bit. And I'll give the disclaimer that Jay Bruce isn't this good.
Right.
You know, you expect him to come down to earth, but he's only 30, so it wouldn't be insane if he had the best hitting year of his career either. You know, even if that's a notch or two down from what he's shown us so far, you know, it's not impossible.
Yeah, agreed.
And the Mets lost despite that second home run. So we can now talk about their record officially.
Yes, we can. but I mean, look, you know, I think we try to pride ourselves in not being a doom and gloom type show. So let's wrap up for tonight by talking about some pleasant surprises so far this season. And I think we can't have the conversation without talking about Conforto.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's sort of a repeat of last year in terms of the length of time that he was really good for. I think it was May 1st last year was the game against Mr. Dirtbike. see, it all ties together. Those improv classes in college and shows, the callbacks, it's all here. None of this was planned.
But yes, it all, and.
Yep. So yeah, this was the point last year that his season took a turn for the worse. You know, obviously, some people would chalk that up entirely to whatever went on with his wrist and never really healing the rest of the way. I tended to be a little more on the side of, look, it's not just a bad month. He had essentially a 5-month stretch where his numbers were just awful.
Right.
Whatever the case, whether it was the wrist or just struggling because he's a young baseball player in, you know, Major League Baseball, man, has he been good this year.
And he seems to be pretty unflappable, which is a lot of fun to watch. A young player who's just comfortable in his own skin, likes being part of the spotlight. You know, he's just, he's been a delight to watch. I was a fan before, but it's been so much fun to watch him play. And he's quickly becoming one of my favorite Mets to watch play baseball.
Yeah. You know, looking at the, man, I'm going from one extreme to the other here with him, but let's hope that several years down the road, that season last year, those numbers will be like when you look at a stat sheet for Robinson Cano.
Yeah.
Where, you know, he had a little more, you know, he had 3 seasons under his belt before he had the bad one. But I remember around that time, like, I don't know, you know, is that guy really as good as people have kind of made him out to be, that kind of thing. And then after that, he just took off. And, you know, it's maybe Conforto is even a better hitter than that in the long run. That's a pretty lofty expectation.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But, yeah, it would be nice. Clearly, whatever happens this year with playing time, you know, mixing and matching parts and just healthy players, he's at least gotten himself playing time the rest of the way. You know, and even if that's 4 or 5 starts a week, doesn't start against lefties, you know, some of the rotation of resting different outfielders that we've talked about, he's here to stay unless he has a month where he craters again.
It's funny. On the broadcast, I think it was Friday night, Gary Cohen said, you know, he'll never be left behind again, essentially, that he has done enough now to prove that he won't be the odd man out the next time there's an outfield roster crunch. And I guess this is the pessimist in me. I could still see Collins choosing to sit him over Granderson from here on out. If Granderson starts hitting a little bit, I could see Conforto's playing time being the main sufferer from that.
Yeah. But yeah, so far this thing has worked itself out, and it probably will continue to.
Let's hope so.
But yeah, no, it's, it gives you hope. And geez, I'm bringing up 2018 twice in one show. Well, regardless, we know that he's a corner outfielder. The corners next year are Cespedes in left, Conforto in right. That's what's happening.
Yeah.
And that's something that's good. That's something to look forward to. You know, I think, oh, one thing we didn't touch on, and I won't take up too much time with it, but I think one of my bigger frustrations so far, and it's been mitigated by the fact that Reyes hit some home runs, still hasn't looked great defensively at third, but you know, Cabrera has been kind of powering through his own hamstring thing. Would it kill them to give Rosario just a week? Not in the sense that, you know, he's hitting 400 in Vegas, which is what he should be doing. That's
right,
great.
Right.
Encouraging, you know, to see. But sort of that reluctance. I feel less that way with Smith, and I know some people with Duda out might be more inclined to have Smith get a cup of coffee right now. But, yeah, I don't know. We are past the extra year of control. You can still manipulate Super 2 if a guy comes up, you know, as sort of a fill-in on a short-term basis. They've carried three catchers for what,
far too long,
almost a week now, and three catchers and eight relievers. I don't get it. And you know, if you can get Cabrera enough rest to the point that he's fully healthy, I would hope that there's a non-zero chance that Rosario could be called up to see if he can help before June, whatever, you know, 15th or whatever the day is that it ends up being. It's always an estimate because it's all relative.
Right, right.
But yeah, that's my gripe. I think there's a guy who's not that far away from being major league ready who could help the team.
Right now?
Like, yeah.
Yeah. My general feeling is that when Flores comes back from the DL, you're going to see Cabrera hit the DL. Because of this new 10-day DL, you can just manipulate things a lot easier. It's not as long of a time. So I think you're going to see the team essentially put their foot down with Cabrera once they have a major league ready talent that they think is ready. For some reason, the team is very reluctant to bring up minor league players before they're not just hitting 400 in Vegas, before they're hitting 450 in Vegas. You know what I mean? It's just they seem to really, really not like to bring up their top prospects until they're absolutely certain they're going to thrive.
Yeah. Yeah, and I remember the Conforto call-up at the time. It wasn't a total shock by the day it happened, but a week before it happened, it didn't seem like it was even anywhere near imminent. So, yeah, I would say the tendency to not want to call a player up until you think you can call him up without sending him back down.
Uh-huh.
That seems fair. That seems like sort of what they've done. It, you know, sounds right with my memory anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody's different, but Byron Buxton has been up and down. Albeit a younger player than Conforto was when each of them first got called up. Mike Trout, one of the strangest things ever, really, is that he struggled at all once. You know, he comes up, really was mediocre in his first 40 games, and then that will barely be... That is a footnote in what could be the greatest baseball career of all time. So
you sound like Ted Berg now.
Well, I read a lot of Ted, but he's right.
He is right.
the dude, he's playing on another level. I am very much looking forward to him coming to Citi Field. I am hoping that he is the only Angel who does good things that weekend because I still want the Mets to win the games, but. You know, you just don't get to see Mike Trout that much. I know I can go see him at Yankee Stadium, and I have done that sometimes. But I don't know. It's fun to see a player on that level. Like, I don't take it for granted that we get to see Giancarlo Stanton play 19 times a year.
Well, it's more like 13 times a year because he's always
yes. hurt. Yes. Yeah, right, right. We get to see him play before school comes back.
Yeah.
Generally. So, yeah, there you go. That's my gripe.
Well, I'm glad we got a gripe in from you because I feel like I do all the griping sometimes. So, all right, well, next week, hopefully, the Mets don't bungle an injury and we get some players back.
Back to Forgotten Mets. I'm your host this week, Brian Renzi. And with all the terrible news regarding pitchers for the Mets so far in 2017, and with Fangraphs just publishing a analysis that suggests Robert Gsellman may be also pitching injured, things look pretty grim at the moment. But it's hard to remember sometimes that actually the much ballyhooed 1980s Mets staff had a year even worse than this one. That was 30 years ago, 1987, when Dwight Gooden missed the first 2 months of the year with drug suspension. Bobby Ojeda was done for the year by May with an elbow injury. David Cohn missed over 2 months with a broken finger when he tried to bunt. Sid Fernandez missed 3 weeks. Ron Darling missed the last 3 weeks of the regular season. Even Rick Aguilera got injured and missed time. Thrown an injury to Roger McDowell, and the Mets needed some serious pitching help. And so badly, in fact, that they tried to bring Tom Seaver out of retirement, which, until I did some research today on the 87 staff, I totally forgot that there were 2 weeks in June of 87 when Tom Terrific was gearing up to pitch again in a Mets uniform. But breaking my heart, decided he didn't have it anymore and officially retired. So, this Forgotten Mets obviously is about none of these well-known pitchers. This is about one of the wonderful oddities of Mets history, the side-arming Southerner known as Terry Leach. Terry, through mid-90s, when he was at Auburn as a college player, and he was picked in the 1976 supplemental draft by the Red Sox, but the pick was voided when he was ruled ineligible due to age. So he found himself back at college for his senior year, but his hopes of being drafted again vanished when he blew out his elbow. No longer able to overpower hitters with now diminished velocity, this injury led Leach to develop his distinctive sidewinder delivery, with a release point that was close to the ground and had his knee dragging in the dirt. He caught on with the Braves as an undrafted free agent and kicked around the minors some, looking to earn some respect. And he put up consistently pretty excellent WHIP and ERA numbers until finally getting a call to Flushing at age 27 in 1981 with the Mets, where he appeared in 21 games, all but one in relief, and put up an awesome 2.55 ERA. In 1982, he also appeared in 21 games, lowered his FIP by a decent margin, and also made he only made one start that year too, but it happened to be one of the greatest starts in Mets history. The last series of the year in Philadelphia, Rick Ownby was pulled at the last moment due to a blister, and Leach was pushed into action on short notice and flung a one-hitter in 10 innings in Philly, which had New York abuzz about a terrible Mets team late in the year. And according to a Saber page on Leach, there was a luggage mix-up at the airport, and the umpiring crew of that game were dressed in spare Phillies uniforms and groundskeeper's gear, kind of making it a somewhat magical game for more than one reason. However, that amazing performance was his last in the majors for 3 years. Evidently, didn't impress enough. During that time, he was traded twice before receiving an unconditional release after his second go-round with the Braves, allowing the Mets to bring him back into their fold. And he was dominant down in Tidewater in 85. That got him into 22 Major League games, including 4 starts, including a shutout. His ERA was just under 3, his FIP just over 3 for the year. But in 86, he couldn't crack the Mets' awesome staff. He did, once again, show strong at Tidewater, but only got into a handful of Major League games in April and May, and a home plate collision dislocated his shoulder and cost him a September call-up at the end of the year. And Saber site had a couple of awesome nuggets, which also included that Leach was one of 4 players who appeared in games for the 1986 Mets who was not awarded a World Series ring until Randall K. Myers, one of the others, started putting some pressure on Wilpon a couple years later when he had earned a spot in the bullpen, and eventually Randy Myers got Leach one of these rings as he split the costs with Wilpon, even then earning the nickname Coupon. Anyway, Terry Leach, 33 years old, definitely was not in the plan for the team in 1987, but with all the chaos on the staff, Leach did make the team on opening day. He started as reliever and quickly made himself invaluable. So invaluable, in fact, that Davey Johnson pitched him 4 straight days in May. I remember listening to the radio incredulously and hanging my head as Leach was brought in that 4th straight day to save the day after John Mitchell had got knocked out of the box in the 3rd inning. I was 9 years old at the time, and even I knew this was abusive and expected the worst. I don't know, but, I mean, you ever feel like listening to impending doom on a radio broadcast makes you feel more distant and helpless than watching it? Well, my fears proved to be unfounded, because similar to Hansel Robles, who pulled the 4 days in a row pitching trick recently, Leach amazingly went 2 1/3 innings to hold down the fort for a decimated staff. He ended up getting credit for the win, his second in those 4 days, and within a week, he was in the starting rotation. That heroic effort that I just talked about put him on the radar as my favorite Met in 1987. He was a strange counterpoint to the other hurlers out there, looking like he was throwing frisbees with an arm made out of rubber. And he was a pitcher who got his uniform dirty every game. I love Dykstra and Backman for doing that, but hey, here's a pitcher. His knees always dirtied up. Anyway, Leach couldn't have thrown more than 80 miles an hour, really, but his slider looked like it actually broke upwards. It was really fascinating stuff, very Dickey-esque. So it was really quite a carpet ride when Leach and his sweet mustache went from June 1st to August 15th. That's 11 starts and 2 relief stints without a loss. He won his first 10 decisions of the year, which was a club record. By the time he was brought back to earth by Wrigley Field and suffered his only loss of the year, a game I also remember listening to on the radio, Leach had put up an incredible record and finished 11-1 in 44 appearances, including 12 starts, which helped keep the Mets in the pennant race down into the final weeks. In 88, he was just awesome in relief. And he also pitched 5 scoreless innings in the NLCS over 3 appearances. But then came the fire sale in 1989, and Leach was one of the first ones to go. Traded to the Royals early on to ostensibly make room for prospect David West. And that didn't work out so hot. The oft-overlooked Leach, though, had finished his Mets career 24-9 with a 3.11 ERA and 176 career appearances for the Mets. He did actually earn a World Series ring outright when he pitched for the in the 1991 World Series for the Minnesota Twins. And he hung around for a couple more years, retiring at age 39 with the White Sox. Now, again, according to the Sabre site, it's worth picking up a copy of Terry Leach's autobiography called Things Happen for a Reason, The True Story of an Itinerant Life in Baseball, published in 2000, and highlights Leach's folksy Southern charm and skill as a storyteller. So, I think I'm going to have to check that one out on Amazon. But, anyway, thanks for listening. Checking out a little part of baseball history where, hey, who knows who might step up and become the next Leach, Gesellman, Lugo. Only time will tell. Catch you next time. Down hazy memory lane, this has been Brian Renzi with Forgotten Mets.
Hey everyone, this is Steve Saipa, and I'm back to go over our minor league plays of the week for week 4. So before we get to that, let's just look and see how all the affiliates did for the week. The Las Vegas 51s went 2-3 and are entering week 5 with an 11-12 record, which puts them 2 games behind the Salt Lake Bees for first place in the division. The Binghamton Rumble Ponies went 4-2 and are entering week 5 with a 10-9 record, which puts them 2 games behind the Trenton Thunder for first place. The St. Lucie Mets went 2-5 and are entering the week with a 9-14 record, which puts them 3 games behind the Palm Beach Cardinals for first place. And finally, the Columbia Fireflies went 3-4 and are entering week 5 with a 12-12 record, which puts them three and a half games behind the Greenville Drive and the Rome Braves for first place in the division. So, for week 4, our pitcher of the week is Binghamton Rumble Pony right-hander Mickey Janis. He made 2 starts this week. In his first on the 23rd, he pitched 7 innings, allowing 3 hits, no runs, 2 walks, and 2 strikeouts. And then on his second on the 29th, he pitched 6.1 innings, allowing 2 hits, 2 runs, 4 walks, and 6 strikeouts. So in total for the week, he pitched 13.1 innings, allowing 2 runs, 5 hits, 6 walks, and 8 strikeouts. So for you, those of you who don't know him, Janis was signed by the Mets in July 2015 after he put up a 1.18 ERA for the Long Island Ducks. He had some immediate success with St. Lucie, but since then he's kind of been up and down. And, you know, that is the life of a knuckleballer. His story is kind of the common knuckleball story. He was a late round draftee, selected in the 44th round of the 2010 draft by the Rays. He was released 1 year later, and he still had the will to play baseball, so he signed with a bunch of indie teams between 2011 and 2015. He played with the Lake Erie Crushers, the Bridgeport Bluefish, the Southern Maryland Blue Crabs, the Long Island Ducks, and he even had a stint with the Brisbane Bandits in the Australian Baseball League. And during that period, he kind of fooled around with the knuckleball, and he turned to it as a last resort to save his baseball career around 2013, which is when he was playing in Australia. So obviously, when you think knuckleball and the Mets, you think of R.A. Dickey, praise Dickey. And there are a few comparisons between the two. Janis's delivery is similar to Dickey, and he uses a two-finger grip on his knuckleball like Dickey. And he throws his knuckleball a little harder than most knuckleballers, sitting in the high 70s and low 80s. The highest it's ever topped out is about 84. But unlike Dickey, Janis throws his knuckleball hard most of the time, and he only kind of periodically mixes in more traditional slow ones. And he grips the ball at the bottom of the horseshoe, as opposed to the top. And he also doesn't have that the impeccable control that Dickey had with the Mets, nor does he have that it factor in his knuckleball that struck out so many batters like Dickey. Janis also has a decent fastball. It sits about 86 to 90, and he generally throws it to kind of throw batters off and, you know, just sneak in a quick one for a strike. So all in all, Janis really probably doesn't have that much upside, but, you know, he is a knuckleballer, so who knows. He generally gives whatever team he's playing for some innings, you know, keeps in the ballgame. And really, you know, he's only 29, so in knuckleball years, he's still a baby. So for all we know, he might peak, you know, 10 years when he's 39. We've seen it before, you know, and that's the beauty of the knuckleball. So he's a guy to, you know, don't expect too much from, but he's a guy to root for. And now our hit of the week for week four is Binghamton Rumble Pony center fielder Champ Stewart. He is 8 for 18 with 1 double, 1 triple, 1 home run, 4 RBI, 4 walks, 3 strikeouts, and 5 stolen bases for the week. So, just to get into Champ's backstory a little bit, he was drafted in the 6th round of the 2013 draft out of Brevard College down in North Carolina, but he actually isn't from North Carolina or the South or anywhere in the U.S. He was actually born in the Bahamas in Freeport, which is about 80 miles off the coast of the U.S. and is, you know, a big tax shelter used by a bunch of businesses that operate here to get away from Uncle Sam. And he moved to North Carolina when he was in high school, and he attended college in Brevard County there, too. And another thing is his name isn't actually Champ. His name is Jervis, but his dad always called him his little champ, so the nickname just stuck. So anyway, when Champ was drafted, he was very, very raw. And basically, he was a pretty good athlete with amazing speed, a decent arm, and a lot of rawness at the plate. And since then, he's kind of refined his game a little bit, but if you simplify Champ into as basic a description as you can, that's still pretty much the best way to describe him. So let's just talk about his defense first. At the time when he was drafted, he was kind of raw in the field, but all of the work that he's put in over the years since getting drafted, he's turned himself into a good fielder. I don't want to say he's a plus center fielder because, you know, being a plus center fielder has certain connotations to it, but he's definitely average, above average, you know, an average center fielder at the very least, and an above average center fielder. In the past, he didn't really get good reads on the ball, and he basically just relied on his speed to cover for his lack of being able to track it in the air, but he's gotten a lot better at that, and now he basically uses his speed to get to the ball and just kind of settle and be comfortable in catching it. And then his arm is also above average, borderline plus, so having a plus arm from a center fielder that also has, you know, plus range, that's a game changer at times. And unlike his improvements in the field, though, Champ has never really gotten all that much better at the plate. His swing isn't too complex. It's pretty level and realistically is designed more to spray line drives over the place. But Champ likes to swing hard, and he tries to sell it for power. And that really isn't the best idea since his bat speed is only kind of average. And, you know, he's not a big guy, and he doesn't really have the frame for kind of power hitting. But that aside, his biggest flaw really is his pitch recognition. That really has just never developed over the years. You know, part of that could be because he's a little bit of a late bloomer, you know, because where he comes from, the Bahamas, they don't really have as intense kind of little league and everything like that. And when he came to the U.S. as, you know, a late teenager, that's really when he started dedicating himself to baseball. But whatever the reason is, you know, he's always had a hard time recognizing breaking balls, and as a result, he's basically always had a 30% strikeout rate, more or less. He's walked generally at a 10% rate, so that's helpful, but, you know, at the end of the day, if you can't recognize the off-speed stuff, you're going to strike out a lot, and that's not going to cut it. His inability to pick up on spin also kind of causes him to lunge and get out in front of a lot of pitches, which, in addition to all those strikeouts, leads to a lot of, you know, weak ground balls. So the thing is, with Champ, his defensive ability and all that speed, even if he is a terrible hitter, he could conceivably have a role on a Major League Baseball team. It would be an extremely limited role, you know, basically just pinch hitting and, pinch running and being a defensive replacement. But we've seen guys like Billy Hamilton at the beginning of his career and Terrence Gore provide value just based on their speed and defense in the right situations. So theoretically, you know, it is conceivable that one day Champ Stewart makes it to the Mets in some capacity. I know there was some discussion last season at the end of the year of having him brought up to the Major League team to do, you know, exactly that. But they were more interested in sending him to the AFL and getting him more reps down there, over there, so they didn't do that. But at some point, you know, he could be wearing a New York Mets uniform in Queens. So anyway, those are our minor league plays of the week for week 4, and I will be back next week to go over week 5 on Amazing Avenue Audio.
As this season goes on a downward spiral, why don't we take a look back on a year in which just about everything went right, 1986. The playoffs were unforgettable, but there were many regular season games that were also crucial to the Mets' domination of the National League East. Here are the top 5, starting with the division clincher on September 17th against the Cubs. The Mets couldn't have picked a better time to go on a slump, if there is such a thing. By dropping 3 straight in Philadelphia and 1 of 2 in St. Louis, they would get the chance to celebrate at Shea. It was appropriate that Dwight Gooden would be the pitcher that would bring it home, tossing a complete game. But for all the hitting stars that got the Mets to this point, it would be a rookie, Dave Magadan, that would shine. With Keith Hernandez suffering from the flu, Magadan filled in wonderfully, going 3-for-4 with 2 RBIs in a 4-2 victory. In what would be a 108-win regular season, a playoff berth was a foregone conclusion much earlier than it would be for your average team. That didn't mean there weren't some dramatic endings. Take August 27th versus the San Diego Padres, for instance, our number 4 game. The Mets couldn't hold an early 5-0 advantage. San Diego scored 1 in the 6th and 4 more in the bottom of the 8th. Jesse Orozco held down the fort with 2 scoreless innings as the game moved into extras, still tied at 5. The Mets would regain the lead in the 11th thanks to a Keith Hernandez sacrifice fly that would plate Lenny Dykstra. Nails was crucial to New York's victory with his defensive play soon after. Gary Templeton's leadoff double to start the bottom half immediately put the tying run in scoring position. After Doug Sisk struck out the next Padre, Tim Flannery came up and singled up the middle. Templeton had ideas of scoring, but Dykstra short-circuited that plan, throwing Templeton out at home despite a nasty collision with catcher John Gibbons. The mayhem at the plate gave Flannery the idea of trying to extend his double one base further, but Gibbons had the presence of mind to nail him before reaching third. 8-2-5 if you're scoring at home. Before Ray Knight was an October hero, he was instrumental in ending a thrilling extra-inning affair against the club the Mets would meet in the NLCS. Knight's walk-off home run in the bottom of the 10th against the Houston Astros on July 3rd was preceded by Daryl Strawberry's 2 home runs, the last of which also came in the 10th, and occurred with 1 runner on and New York down 5-3, countering Houston's pair of runs off Orozco in the top half. Another subplot was the 4 prior at-bats by Knight, each one resulting in Ks. Ray's golden sombrero was long forgotten once his drive landed over the left field fence. The pre-July 4th fireworks from Strawberry and Knight created the number 3 1986 regular season game. That, however, was nothing compared to the sparks that flew nearly 3 weeks later in Cincinnati and the number 2 game on our list. It would have been an ordinary 3-1 Reds victory had Dave Parker held on to a Keith Hernandez fly ball, but he didn't. The 2 runners that were on base scored. Then things got crazy. Ray Knight was in the middle of it again. When Eric Davis used a hard slide to steal third on Jesse Orozco in the bottom of the 10th, Knight, a former amateur boxer, took exception by popping Davis in the face. That, to no surprise, incited a melee. When the dust settled, Knight and Kevin Mitchell were ejected. Daryl Strawberry had already been tossed in the 5th. Those departures, along with the other substitutions Davey Johnson had made prior to the brawl, left the Mets manager shorthanded. Ed Hearn went in to catch, Gary Carter moved to third base, and with no everyday players remaining, Johnson put Orozco in right field and had Roger McDowell come in to pitch. The 2 relief pitchers would then spend the remainder of the game switching back and forth between the mound and right field, depending on the matchup. The game stayed tied until Howard Johnson launched a 3-run shot to right center. The suddenly versatile McDowell was summoned from the outfield to close it out. Who said you need a full roster to win? July 22nd was the wildest event of the 86 season, but the four-game set against the St. Louis Cardinals was the most significant. In fact, the series itself is the choice for the number one spot on our list. The Mets didn't face many challenges on their road to the NL East title. They made good on Davey Johnson's preseason promise of domination, though it probably wouldn't have been possible without quickly turning the tables on the team that beat them out for the pennant one season ago, and thus setting the tone for the remaining 5 months. In the opener, the Mets were down to their final two outs facing Cards closer Todd Worrell. With a man on, Howard Johnson answered New York's prayers with an equalizing home run. One inning later, the Mets got a run and an eventual victory. Game two would turn into a laugher. Dwight Gooden went the distance on a five-hit shutout and was aided by an offense that broke open a late 2-0 lead with 5 eighth-inning runs and then two more in the ninth. 9-0 New York would be the final. Game three appeared to be heading in a similar direction after the Mets tallied a 4 spot in the first off Danny Cox. However, 4 is all they could get. St. Louis rallied to close the gap to a 4-3 ninth-inning deficit and threatened to come all the way back with 2 on and 1 out versus Jesse Orozco. Jesse would get the save, but it would be Wally Backman who would save the game, diving for a Terry Pendleton grounder and starting a 4-6-3 game-ending double play. Bob Ojeda's complete game effort in the Sunday finale, his first as a National League pitcher, completed the sweep and extended the Mets' win streak to 8. It eventually would reach a franchise-best 11. More importantly, the series would send a direct message to the St. Louis Cardinals that the Mets would rule the roost in the National League East this year. Before long, Whitey was raising the white flag. That's all for this list. I'm Brian Wright. Once again, you can follow me on Twitter at BrianWright86.
It's May 3rd, and I don't want to say that the Mets season is over, but man, the Mets season looks over on May 3rd. This morning, we had the lovely news that Noah Syndergaard, who Monday, whenever it is, last year's game with the lat injury, is going to LA to get a second opinion. And from Joel Sherman, initial conservative estimates is he'll be out 3 months. You don't come back from that. You don't come back from losing your ace for 3 months, even if you have some pitching depth, which everyone is quickly realizing that the Mets do not actually have, because you're going to get you know, Rafael Montero starts on Friday. They're talking about Sean Gilmartin. We're talking about staff ace Adam Wilk. And no one's hitting still. Jay Bruce is hitting. Jose Reyes is hitting a bit more. Darno's hitting. Conforto's hitting. It's not enough. Granderson can turn it around. It's just this team was built on pitching, and the pitching has fallen apart faster than I think any of us could have expected, even considering that it was the Mets and this was inevitable. They're going to trade for Bartolo at the trade deadline. That was always inevitable. It's even more so now. They're going to have to, I don't know. Are they going to look outside the organization for pitching depth and not subject us to 9 months of Sean Gilmartin? I hope so. But then again, there's not a whole lot out there. The free agents are still free agents for a reason. Except for Kelly Johnson. I still don't understand that one. But I don't know. I don't know that it's time to start talking about selling off the trade deadline because it's ridiculous and it's May 3rd. But I don't see how this team competes. You're not getting the East. The Nationals just look absolutely unbeatable despite the fact that the Mets took 2 out of 3 from them. That was a fluke. They look just 1-9. That lineup is insane, even without Adam Eaton. And you can play for the wild card again. And technically, theoretically, Syndergaard will be back for that. But I don't know. I don't know. This season has gone off the rails really quickly and really sharply.
Well,
Well, folks, that does it for another installment of Amazing Avenue Audio. Thank you so much for listening. Please go to AmazingAvenue.com for all your Mets needs this season and every season. We have game threads, game recaps, news, analysis, even some funny stuff now and then. So go to AmazingAvenue.com and check it out. Also, check out the show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Amazing Avenue. You can download the show directly from blogtalkradio.com, or you can go to Apple Podcasts and download it from there, or from Stitcher, or from whatever your podcatcher of choice is. While on Apple Podcasts, please rate, review, and subscribe. That really does help the show quite a bit. And you can follow all the contributors to the show today on Twitter. I am at Brian Needs a Nap. Chris is at Chris McShane. Steve is at Steve Saipa. Kate is at Kate E. Feldman. And then we have the other two Brians. Brian Renzi is at BRenz78. And Brian Wright is at BrianWright86. So hopefully next time we talk, I feel like I say this every week, the Mets have won some games. They won big last night, but they win some more games as well as get some good injury news. So until then, let's go Mets!